Thanks for downloading Analysis from the BBC. Gentrification, the process of neighbourhoods rapidly going up market, is occurring in cities right across the UK. But can and should policymakers control it if it goes too far? Here's David Baker.
It's a pretty grey morning here in Archway in North London, and there's a huge amount of construction going on around us and a huge amount of traffic driving around that construction, because this is an area that's really going through a transformation. On our left here, a big 15...
Archway is typical of many areas in the UK when gentrification is in full swing. You can hardly move there for a crane or a new coffee shop, and there's no sign that that frantic development is going to stop anytime soon. And that's probably good news. Gentrification has produced enormous gains for urban areas like Archway. Incomers, often young, energetic and creative, bring with them new ideas, new business and new money.
This is a cafe called The Bread and Bean, and it opened, what, 3 or 4 years ago now? And I think for me it became symbolic of the beginnings of the gentrification in Archway. Of course, now what's happened is we've gone up that kind of mainstream step, and Starbucks opened about 3 months ago opposite Archway Tube.
When this kind of gentrification accelerates, something important happens. A new wave of more affluent gentrifiers arrive, who push out those edgier incomers and transform the area yet again, and not necessarily for the better. And this is a story much wider than just cities. It's about who takes responsibility for the places we live in, wherever they are. I'm David Baker, and in this edition of Analysis, I'll be asking if it's possible to freeze gentrification in this interesting creative phase. Or will a rising property market create more and more streets that are wealthy, bland and soulless? Time for an artisan coffee with Loretta Lees, an urban geographer from Leicester University and an authority on gentrification.
Well, I think if you look at the kind of literature on gentrification, it talks about the kind of classic gentrification where independent, you know, kind of organic coffee shops would get involved. But then it becomes the more expensive kind of gentrification that's more sanitising. To give you an example, so the house next door to me on my street was owned by an old Irish couple who'd lived there since 1952, bought it for £1,000. The guy died, and then his wife decided she'd better live with her daughter, so they sold the house off. So the woman who has bought the house is in media. She bought the house for £900,000 and then completely gutted it. So she ripped out all the chimneys, put in wood-burning stoves, the real kind of typical gentrifier aesthetic. And that's an example of something very recent, but it's an example of that kind of classic early wave gentrification. The problem is the general public see a tarted up landscape, the streetscape gets improved, the quality of shops might be slightly better, but the kind of corollary is that you get displacement and then also a very sanitised environment. So if you look at New York City now, you know, 42nd Street used to be an exciting, gritty place to go and visit as a tourist. Now it's Dullsville.
And it's not just a matter of how chic an area is or how many quirky coffee shops it has. Gentrification raises really fundamental questions about how we live.
Depending on how rapidly the process of gentrification occurs, then the spaces are going to be more homogenised, so you'll be tending down the line to mix more with people like yourself. So, of course, you don't get to meet people who are different to you or other than you on the street, which is actually really important in terms of democracy, in terms of, you know, us having feelings about our fellow citizens and things like that.
Why does all of this matter?
I think it matters because this is one of the biggest urban processes happening worldwide, and here it's happening in London on our doorstep. It matters if low-income groups are displaced out of cities and we end up living in a homogenous kind of upper-income block. We end up with London as Paris, you know, so Paris has a kind of wealthy core and then all the social problems get pushed out to the banlieues. Is that really what we want for London as well?
This way of thinking has been shaped by a hugely influential thinker in this debate, Richard Florida, a professor at the University of Toronto. He's long argued that diversity is not only good for democracy, it's good for business too.
The more diverse a city or neighbourhood is, the higher the fraction of foreign-born people, the more open it is to immigrants, the more open it is to the gay and lesbian community, the more it's a place where artists and cultural creatives who may not have the most money in the world, my bohemian factor, the more it is open to those places, the more economically thriving, in particular, the more innovative it is, you know. But the worry now is that with the massive Back to the City movement that's occurred in London, of course, but New York City, San Francisco, and a few others, as affluent people, financial people, oligarchs, plutocrats, I could go on, the list is innumerable, but as the city becomes invaded by these very wealthy groups, who, you know, and they're not buying an apartment or a house to live in, they're buying it as a new class of financial asset, and often these neighborhoods are dark. The worry is that this process of this massive infusion of the global super rich actually begins to dilute this diversity, wash out this diversity, and make these neighborhoods more and more homogeneous, less diverse, and begins to dampen down and dullify this creative impetus, which is in fact the cornerstone of great urban neighborhoods and great cities.
And he says, the real danger is that cities will become the exclusive preserve of the super rich.
We are living in an age of winner-take-all urbanism. A very few number of cities, a handful or two of cities in the world economy, are benefiting. And within those cities, their premier central neighborhoods are becoming essentially gated and gilded communities for the wealthy. And the wealthy, the global super rich, the plutocracy, are pushing out the wealthy of that society, the artisan creatives, and eventually they'll push out the techies too.
Florida has been making this argument for more than 20 years, and he's backed up his thesis with good data. And what's significant is that pretty much everyone else has come to agree with him. So, if this juggernaut of gentrification can lead to dull, sanitized, and economically doomed cities, where do we look for clues about how we can put the brakes on? Well, one answer is Berlin, a city that comes up a lot when you ask people about how to manage gentrification. This is a city with a remarkably highly regulated property sector. 85% of flats here are rented, and tenants are often guaranteed security for life. Matthias Bent is from the city's Leibniz Institute for Research in Society and Space. He sees these regulations as an important way of making the free market function better.
It's very much in line with the ordo-liberal conception of what the Germans call soziale Marktwirtschaft, which is socially regulated market economy, which is based on the idea that the market is a superior instrument for allocating goods, but at the same time the state should intervene and make sure that the overall results of the workings of the market work in a way which is good for the society.
Berlin has swathes of regulations that limit rent rises and protect the security of tenants. But they also go further than this. The Milieuschutz is a law that could have been designed to answer Richard Florida's concerns. Its aim is to stop an area becoming too gentrified.
The idea of Milieuschutz is to protect the mix of people who lives in an area at a certain amount of time and which is endangered by rent increases. So what this Milieuschutz does is that it establishes a need for an additional permission if an investor wants to do any building to his apartments. And when he wants to do this, then he or she must get a permission from the borough. And this permission can only be given when what is being done is in line with the aim of protecting the population. So what the most important things that can be done now is to prohibit luxury standards, so second bathroom, marble ceilings, stuff like that can be prohibited by the borough because it would imply rent increases which would be way above what people can pay.
Okay, I guess people hearing this might say, sure, you know, the city can have a say in things like whether someone should be an owner or a property should be rented or whatever. These seem to be contractual things. But really, should the city have something to do with marble ceilings or second bathrooms? Is that really the job of the state?
Well, why not? I mean, if you want to give low-income people a chance to stay put in an area which has seen massive price increases, then one way to justify price increases in the German rental system is to raise the standard. So if you want to have chances that a nurse can pay an apartment, then she sure won't be able to pay it when it has a second bathroom and marble ceilings.
Critics will say that regulations like these suppress development. But in fact, property companies are licking their lips at the opportunities in this fast-growing city. And a city that's following a similar trajectory in the UK is Manchester, whose centre's been transformed since an IRA bomb devastated the area in 1996. Standing in Manchester's northern quarter, you can really see the positive effects of gentrification. This is an area that used to be pretty run down, but all around us now are funky little businesses like independent coffee shops, cool little silversmiths, a bookshop, a printer's. There's even a cat cafe where you can go and have a latte with a load of feline friends. So how do you bring about a transformation like this? Well, one person to ask is the man who's been in charge of this city for about the last 20 years, Sir Richard Leese, leader of the council and one of the most influential local politicians outside London.
If you were to come to Manchester 25 years ago, you would have found around about 500 people living in the city centre. It was not a place where people lived. Over the past 25 years, but particularly over the last decade, it's gone to over 25,000 people and is continuing to accelerate very rapidly. There are different neighbourhoods within the city centre, even though it's quite a compact city centre. The northern quarter is often described as sort of, you know, the bohemian quarter, or the quarter with a bit of an edge. It also has the advantage in that it's not a quarter and it's not in the north, so which adds to that little bit of being a little bit different. Mm-hmm.
And, like his counterparts in Berlin, Richard Leese sees his job as preserving the mix of people who live and work in the city centre.
I think one of the strengths of Manchester is its diversity, and I think all the evidence suggests that the more diverse your city, the more likely you are to be successful. So maintaining that diversity is really, really important to us. Clearly, part of that diversity comes from people on low incomes moving into the city who want to make something of themselves, want to make something of their families. And we need to make sure that we maintain space for low-income families.
Would you like to be running a strategy which is a bit like perhaps happens in Berlin, for example, quite a rigorous regulatory environment here, which actually does keep rents down by law, if you like, by regulatory agreement?
Certainly in terms of the private renters sector, we would like to have a very much tougher regulatory framework for that. Certainly, we'd also like to use what's effectively the bottom end of the market, housing benefit, which it tends to be a part of the economic equation around there, as a way of investing in housing rather than simply translating into profits for what are often not very good landlords.
If you'd like to find out more about the part housing benefit plays, have a listen to our edition of Analysis on the subject on the BBC iPlayer. The Labour leader of Manchester City Council, Sir Richard Leese, may want more powerful tools to deal with the negative effects of gentrification. But from an alternative point of view, I've come to the place where gentrification as a term was first invented. This is the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, and I've come to see the Conservative leader of the council, Nicholas Paget-Brown.
I think what we need are mixed communities. I think it's very dangerous if a place becomes actually not a neighbourhood at all, but just units of housing.
Even on this side of the political divide, you find sympathy with Richard Florida's concerns about gentrification, including the idea that parts of cities will just stagnate.
What about the bits of the borough that people are talking about that are becoming silent, if you like, these famous streets where the lights aren't on anymore, where people are just bought for investment rather than for living?
Well, that's harder to deal with because you're then dealing with a private property transaction, and you're quite right, people from overseas make a purchase of a flat somewhere in the leafier part of the borough, and then it's really not their intention to live in it. The house is under-occupied, and the borough has certainly suffered from that. At the last census, I think we were the only borough in London which didn't see a net increase in population.
You've got a strange situation here. Here's a borough where there's quite a lot of housing need, and there's actually quite a lot of empty houses. And do you wish as a council leader you had a better tool to adjust that?
I don't think I want a power to stop people buying in the private sector, but I do think it's important that we use our own assets as effectively as we possibly can to ensure that we have a balanced community of people who actually live here, who are working here in the borough. That's the duty of the council. It's not really the duty of the council to try and interfere with private markets. And if people want to pay very, very inflated and enormous prices for relatively small properties, that's a matter for them.
Kensington and Chelsea is a true blue Tory council, and Paget-Brown's cautious about bringing in Berlin-style regulations. But he does have areas of real poverty to worry about, especially among the social housing estates in the north of the borough. To address these, he's becoming a developer himself, one with an emphasis on the idea of placemaking. Placemaking is a buzzword in the urban development world at the moment. It means building with an eye to the look and feel of a neighbourhood, as well as to its basic amenities.
It's redesigning and rethinking to make a more attractive neighbourhood, perhaps not to be frightened of the old idea of a street with a garden or a square or a public place where mum can keep an eye on what's going on outside, where neighbours can keep an eye on each other.
I'm looking out at the English Channel from Hastings Pier on the south coast of England. This fine structure recently reopened after falling almost completely into disrepair. Hastings has been a seaside town in decline for many decades, and this project is a symbol of the regeneration that's now happening here. And just up the road are two buildings right next to each other that illustrate very different approaches to gentrification: Rock House and the Hastings Observer Building. I'm going to meet the people behind each of these projects.
We've got 46,000 square feet of the former Hastings Observer newspaper headquarters building.
You can tell this is a pretty solid building.
Very robust. Yeah.
My name is Jeff Kirby. I'm the chief exec of All Living Things, which is the development management company.
So here's one side of the divide. Jeff sees gentrification as both a natural process and a commercial opportunity.
So we have a plan to do 49 loft apartments and specifically targeted at young professionals and creatives who are, you know, working as people do now, 2 days in London, 3 or 4 days a week in Hastings, connecting digitally. And that, we think, will be a tremendous regeneration initiative for the town and also, you know, commercially interesting for us, which, of course, it has to be.
He's a big fan of helping as many people buy their own homes as possible. But what happens when prices rise? How can you stop that new generation of creative young people being pushed out?
Well, I'm not sure if we need to stop it happening. I mean, I would argue from a kind of an urban design and urban economics point of view that this is a natural life cycle of urbanism, and that those very creative people who've created the value in the first place will move on and create value elsewhere.
And he says, the real problem is buy-to-let landlords who deny people their chance of getting their foot on the housing ladder.
This goes completely against the whole principles on which I would want to operate. What we need to do is create greater housing supply and more equity amongst first-time homebuyers to get them into home ownership in the first place. And the way to do that is to create more housing. We need to do high-density, mixed-use, urban densification, and we need to get these projects through the pipeline faster. That's it. More regulation will just make it worse. I mean, we're already in a highly regulated environment, and look what happens. It's all gone wrong, you know. We have interest rates at the lowest they've ever been in this country, and people can't afford to buy a house. How can that be?
Jeff Kirby believes strongly in what he calls the natural life cycle of urbanism. Right next door is someone who wants to interrupt that cycle by buying property and taking it off the market. Hi, Jess.
Hi.
Hi, David Baker, David. BBC.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. So, oh wow, what have we got here?
So this is the sixth floor of Rock House. There's nine floors altogether. But this is the top, and it's we get a fantastic view of the sea.
Beautiful, beautiful looking out there. Jess Steele is a community activist who's playing developers at their own game. She's brought together a group of local people to buy up an old office building and turn it into something of their own.
We've had this really fascinating, slightly quirky community, which others will recognise in other parts of the country, which is, you know, full of artists and musicians, full of community workers, really full of people who scrape a living together and are able to do that because the housing and workspaces are affordable. Now, if housing and workspaces stop being affordable, those people disappear. That means the character of the neighbourhood disappears.
So how does this people power approach to development actually work?
People need to get together and create things like community land trusts, which can actually purchase property or acquire property that might be run down at the moment, raise money to restore it, and then keep it in community freehold long term, so that we can cap the rents, so that we can create some affordable spaces, both residential and places to work, that will last forever and that will help to protect both the community and the neighbourhood.
What effect has Rock House had on the wider area here, this part of Hastings?
So in terms of the impact on the local area, we now have a real hub. We've always had creatives in the area, but we now have a real hub for people who are working in creative industries at a small scale, lots of very small micro enterprises, and people who need places to live and want to be involved in the creative local world. So we've got a real hub for that here now, but I think the biggest thing is the ethics of it start to spread and people start to talk about gentrification in a different way. But I think it's got to be beyond regulation. We have to take action, and the way to do that is to buy property, or at least acquire it in whatever way you can, and take it off the market. So that's where there's been an awful lot of resistance to gentrification, but there haven't been enough positive, active alternatives developed. And I think there are many, many examples of artists kind of chaining themselves to buildings when they're being kicked out. But there are far fewer examples of groups of artists when the building was cheap, getting together and making sure they actually buy it.
And can you, as the landlord, if you like, still get a decent income from that?
You can get a decent income. You can't get a stratospheric income and a massive rise in rents and capital value that too many speculative developers are trying to create. You can get a decent income that makes enough money to keep the properties, you know, well maintained and well managed.
Jess Steele's approach may feel off the wall, and indeed there are only about 20 projects like it around the country. But here's the interesting thing. Big developers are also interested in doing something very like Jess, becoming long-term landlords rather than selling as soon as they can. Martin Evans is a London-based property developer who's writing a book on regeneration.
The biggest issue in my business at the minute is PRS, private rental sector. This is a huge, big shift in private sector residential property development, focusing on build to rent rather than build to sell. The biggest benefit of that shift in building, I think, is that the people who fund those buildings, typically pension funds, large institutional investors, have typically to now been interested in short-term investment in residential property. They invest, they build, they sell, and then they're out. If you're building property to rent, you're in it for the long term. That's significant change in the way those investors operate. It means that in order to keep their customers happy, they want them to stay even longer. So they want their tenants to rent flats for a long time. Why do people rent flats for a long time? Because they like them, because they are in nice places, because where they live is a good place. And so I think we're going to see an emerging greater interest on the part of large property developers and large institutional investors in making the kind of places that make people feel happy.
So we're now in the residence lounge area. Mm-hmm. This is where the concierge is based. We've got a concierge on site who's here Monday to Saturday.
Right, and actually this feels a bit like a hotel, really, isn't it? It's like a reception area, it's a kind of a cool hotel in somewhere like Barcelona or Buenos Aires.
Well, that's exactly what we're looking at.
An example of the PRS model is taking shape in Barking in East London. Granger, a well-established UK developer, has built a block of 100 one, two and three bedroom flats that are for rent, not for sale. The idea is that people want to stay longer and form a community. And according to Helen Gordon, Granger's CEO, who I met in one of the flats for rent, that's also good for her business.
I'm Helen Gordon, Chief Executive of Granger. The business argument for doing this, the reason we really want to invest in communities is we want them to stay. As most people know that when they move house or when they move, if they're a landlord, they know that when your tenant leaves, your customer goes, you have to refresh the place, and we want people to stay longer because obviously that makes a good investment case for us. And it's a very different model than the private developer for sale. So when we're specifying buildings, the sort of things we're looking at is, you know, how are things going to be in a few years' time? How are we going to enable this community to develop, and how's it going to stay there? Because we have a long-term relationship with the building, with the environment, with the community. The important thing about rental is that that doesn't stop when the houses are finished. It carries on. If the environment around this building was deteriorating, that affects our investment. And so we will be having a constant dialogue and getting engaged in that community for that reason.
Do you make more money by having longer term tenants in this way as a developer?
Yes. We make more money by actually keeping our residents happy, keeping them here, not having the same degree of turnover, and keeping a relationship with them. by and large, when people like the building, they look after it, they stay longer, they make it their home.
It's more profit for you.
It is more profitable, yeah.
This is an attractive model that combines the interests of developer, resident, council and local community. But in the property world, money talks. And although Helen Gordon may be happy with the revenue she's seeing, sometimes it's hard to resist the quick returns that a rising market can offer. Maybe the answer to the question, can we have too much gentrification, is no, but we need to find ways to manage it. I've heard a lot of views about how to make that happen, from Berlin's regulations preventing marble ceilings to Jeff Kirby's call for an unleashed free market. Richard Florida, the most powerful critic of the effects of gentrification, argues that the answer lies in politics.
We need to make sure that cities continue to be vehicles for innovation and economic growth. But we also need to ensure that cities, this great diversity, this great clash and clamor of cultures, classes, ethnicities, races, can continue in cities. So we're going to have to see cities as vehicles for redistribution. We're going to have to make sure that service workers are paid enough to live in cities. We're going to have to make sure that people have access to affordable housing. And that's not just going to be provided by the market. That's going to have to be provided by the public sector and social housing. So the reason I'm optimistic is that the new urban crisis, this new kind of urbanized capitalism, makes society's fissures and fault lines, its contradictions, evident in the city itself. In the old model of capitalism, the wealthy were in the suburbs, the poor were in the cities, the cities were the hole in the donut, they could be ignored, they could be bypassed. But now, whether you're the mayor of London or New York or San Francisco or Boston, wherever you are dealing with the fundamental problems of wealth and poverty, of class division, all the things we've been talking about. So what gives me great hope is that it's hard for the wealthy to capture a city entirely.
Personally, I'm not so sure. Politics is a very short-term game, and mayors and politicians tend to move on. Instead, I think it'll take a change in attitude. We need to stop seeing all developers as villains out to make a quick buck. And in this country, at least, we need to get over our obsession with owning our own homes. Something that already seems to be happening. Just 64% of people in the UK now own, compared with 70% just over a decade ago. And I also like the idea of us all becoming placemakers, getting involved with schemes that really have an eye to where we live. Maybe we need to think less about property as an asset class and more about our responsibility for the kind of neighbourhoods we want to live in.
Analysis was presented by David Baker and produced by Peter Snowden. Next week, Edward Sturton asks what leaving the European Union means for Ireland, both north and south. Do get in touch with us. Our email address is analysis@bbc.co.uk. And why not leave us a review or give us a rating on iTunes? And while we're here, I can recommend another fine podcast, The Why Factor, asking why we do the things we do.